In 2018, two homeschooled children were discovered buried in their parents' backyard in Georgia. It made national news.
No one's ever required to ever lay eyes on your children to even see if they're still alive. Extreme child torture, abuse, neglect, malnourishment, educational neglect, medical neglect, rape, children being chained to beds, children being locked in cages.
School provides a place where we check in on the welfare of children for the common benefit of this of us all. Sometimes that's vaccines. Sometimes that's having teachers with a watchful eye.
We're not seeing reports of the ones that are still going on that nobody has even laid eyes on yet.
Those kids might just disappear.
My rhyme ain't good just yet. My brain and tongue just met. And the inference so far, my words don't travel. Far they tangle in my hair and tend to go nowhere. They grow right back inside, right past my brain and eyes into my stomach. Juice where they don't serve my juice. No healthy calories, nutrition values. And I absorb back in the words right through my skin. They sit there festering inside my bowels, the consonants and vowels. The consequence of sound.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is April 29th. This is the continuation of my conversation with Corey DeAngelis of the Reason Foundation and the Educational Freedom Institute. Corey and I today will dig into the academic paper written by Professor Elizabeth Barthollet, published in the Arizona Law Review at the end of last year. Before that, going all the way back to the monologue in the last podcast, I said tongue-in-cheekily that I listen to NPR podcasts, so you don't have to. You know what? You can go ahead and listen to NPR if you have time, if you want to. It's not like everything there is bad. Let me tell you a story, actually. I used to listen to NPR back in the day, 2003, 2004, right before I became utterly captivated by the works of George Norrie and Art Bell on Coast to Coast Radio. You know, here I am listening to NPR talk about why John Kerry is so great. Little do I know that our whole existence is made possible by aliens who genetically engineered the human race thousands of years ago. So thanks, Coast to Coast. And Coast to Coast was a nice gateway into a bunch of other stuff. But it started with NPR. That was me as a college graduate, master's student, becoming finger quotes aware of what was happening in the world. And, you know, I think a lot of what happens on NPR is a little bit dangerous. Because like this episode that I clipped up at the beginning for you there, and then I'm going to play a longer portion of soon, and I played some of in the last intro, there is the appearance of discourse. On the surface, this episode, this is a show called 1A. The episode title was How Should We Regulate Homeschooling? It was released January 2nd, 2020. On the surface, it does not appear terribly unfair. From the episode description, the rules homeschoolers must follow vary from state to state. In some places, all you have to do is keep your child at home. Nothing else is required. Other states require home educators to complete yearly check-ins, or share lesson plans. How should homeschooling be regulated? And should it be regulated at all? My apologies for jumping to conclusions about the title in the last episode. In a quest for answers, we spoke with Jerusha Laughlin, a 1A listener from Wichita, Kansas, who was homeschooled and did homeschool her kids, Brian Ray, president of the National Home Education Research Institute, and Samantha Field, a policy advocate at the Coalition for Responsible Home Education. So Brian is our ally here. He is the only really pro-homeschooling voice in this conversation. Samantha Field, this is how I discovered this episode of 1A, is one of the presenters at Elizabeth Barthollet's upcoming anti-homeschooling conference. But when I began listening to NPR with very few intellectual defenses, I could tell myself a story about how I was hearing all sides of a thing, right? Because there would be, like I said, this appearance of discourse or debate. NPR is not like Slate or Salon or the Young Turks, where it's completely obvious what they are and they can be dismissed as such. This is bias, this is one side of the story, etc. But most people, I think, would listen to this 35-minute podcast episode that at the very beginning of this show, I condensed down to less than 1 minute as far as what I believe the intended impact of it is. All of that you heard was pulled from just 1 5-minute clip that I'm going to play for you soon, and you can decide how impactful it should actually be once the dissenting voice is included. And if you're not listening to it on autopilot with your anti-homeschooling mind already made up. So at the very beginning of the show, you heard all of the most memorable and impactful emotional beats. And through this, not only will you get a taste of Samantha Field, her position on homeschooling, and the depth of her arguments, but I think it's also an effective preview of what the tone will be for this upcoming Harvard Law anti-homeschooling conference where Samantha will be presenting.
Samantha, in 2018, two homeschooled children were discovered buried in their parents' backyard in Georgia. It made national news. One of them hadn't been seen for 4 years. These are the worst cases, of course, but how common are cases like this, that homeschooled children are abused or just disappear off the map?
To be honest, it's impossible to answer that question. Because of the 11 states that require no notice whatsoever, we don't even know how many children are being homeschooled or being kept at home under the technical auspices of homeschooling, but actually aren't being home educated, or states that only require notice, or the other states that you're required to have bookkeeping, but no one's ever required to ever lay eyes on your children to even see if they're still alive.
Brian, we're not going to be interrupting. You're going to get your chance, I promise. Go ahead, Samantha. Right.
So we can't answer that question in an overly confident way. What we do try to do is we maintain a database called Homeschooling's Invisible Children, where with every case that is verifiably like homeschooling was some kind of factor involved, either through double checking with the original investigators or through calling and getting in touch with the families involved. Like our database has found hundreds of cases of extreme child torture, abuse, neglect, malnourishment, educational neglect, medical neglect, rape, children being chained to beds, children being locked in cages, children being chopped up and hidden in freezers and nobody knowing about it for 4 years or more. These cases, we don't know how common they are, but they're not uncommon.
Now, these cases don't mean that homeschooling causes this horrible, horrible abuse.
No, but what
it does mean, perhaps, is that the children are, again, sequestered from society, and because they don't go to school and because nobody is required to check in on them, they're able to fall through the cracks and in some cases disappear between them. Brian, your research certainly touches on whether regulation can help prevent abuse and neglect, and I want to hear you talk about that. But it's also the idea that school provides a place where we check in on the welfare of children for the common benefit of this of us all. Sometimes that's vaccines. Sometimes that's having teachers with a watchful eye over whether kids have bruises. What about the spirit of protecting children where in the case of some homeschooling, and certainly not all, and certainly maybe not causal, those kids might just disappear?
You know, it's horrible anytime a parent or a teacher or anybody does one of these evil things. But I got to really say here, this is so significant. We're talking about controlling a private education forum, and stories are important, experience is important, but they bring out a lot of emotions. But we're talking about public policy here, Todd. And first of all, there has to be a verifiable problem. We're not even at that step with homeschooling. And it's almost as if some people want to find a problem with homeschooling, that there's a disproportionately high amount of abuse or mental psychological problems, when all of the evidence so far is just the opposite. We took the data from Samantha's organization. I personally analyzed it. Their data found zero correlation between the degree of state regulation of homeschooling and abuse. So when you do not even have a correlation, it is extremely difficult to argue that there's a problem. And then you'd have to go the next step, and you said this a couple times, Todd. Even if there were a correlation, then you'd have to establish causation. But there's not even a correlation. So nobody has evidence of any disproportionate problem with homeschoolers. In fact, the Commission on Abuse, the U.S. Commission on Abuse, said risk factors, they do not include the type of schooling a child is in.
Samantha,
that's a national commission.
Samantha, briefly respond to Brian's research statements here.
So when he's looking at our database, what he is not highlighting is the fact that our database, by its very nature, cannot be exhaustive. We can only find the cases that are available through public records, are available through news media reports. So we're only finding ones that people have found out about. We're not seeing reports of the ones that are still going on that nobody has even laid eyes on yet. So no, you can't make definitive statements about correlation because there's not enough data.
So yes, on the surface, this appears to be a quest for answers, a debate, if you will, but thanks to emotionally charged arguments drowning out what I think are the rational counterpoints, in this case coming almost entirely from Brian Ray, almost all NPR listeners are going to walk away from this with their perceptions about homeschooling effectively massaged. So there's a couple other manipulations that I wanted to talk about related to this Harvard thing and on this issue more generally before we actually get into the Arizona Law Review paper that Bartlett wrote. Look at the image used in the Harvard Magazine article. It's actually the thumbnail for the show. You see, I made some notes on it. It's really over the top. It shows a bunch of normal children, right? Schooled children playing around outside. And then you see this homeschooled child in a house where the windows have prison bars. And you see the siding is like lined with books, reading, writing, arithmetic, and the Bible. We've talked before about propaganda using images to attack people's emotions, because images aren't arguments, so they're harder to diagram and deconstruct. We talked on social media last week, and I might have mentioned it. I know I talked about it on a couple of bonus shows, the nurse versus idiot image that was circulating. So there was these lockdown protests in Colorado. There were numerous lockdown protests around the country. But one of the images that was used to, as basically a synopsis for everything that was happening was, look at this person in a USA shirt hanging out of their gas-guzzling pickup truck with a sign that says Land of the Free, and their path is being blocked by this very heroic-looking male nurse doing like this superhero pose in his scrubs and his mask and his sunglasses. And so without saying a word, there's this presentation of an apparent dichotomy. Like, there's two ways you can feel about this. Are you with idiot or are you with heroic science guy? We've also seen in this whole narrative the hasty generalization of anybody who has questions about this very, very Orwellian state of affairs right now. Anybody who has questions about that is just a person who wants a haircut. Like, with everything going on in the world, all this person, all this selfish, ignorant person can think about is their hair. So that's been used as a kind of a hasty generalization for these people, too. This also relates to something called the fallacy of composition, which is a very reliable tool. It's when you take a selection from a group and you basically make that the rule for the whole group. So I was super suspicious. You know, I'm a suspicious guy. I used to listen to Coast, if I haven't mentioned that ever. And I keep seeing all these people at the rally say, I just want to get my hair cut. I just want to get my hair cut. And I don't know what kind of prompting there was or what the story behind that is, but immediately you see that statement and its use in this narrative as a way of like, okay, idiot says a thing, just like I said in the, it was a bonus show, so I'll tell you what I said. These rallies are bad optics because you only have to go interview the three most babbling idiots at any one of these things, and then you make that the rule for the whole group. But again, remember, of course, these are just the tactics of sloppy bloggers and talking heads and people like Trevor Noah and Stephen Colbert, who are just, over the last 10 years, we've watched trade in their rebellious spirit and their irreverence to be essentially the Mr. Rogers neighborhood of public opinion manipulation. These are their tactics, right? These are certainly not the tactics of the responsible people in the academy. But an image is a very difficult thing to argue against, whether we're talking about, you know, current events or just the way this Harvard Magazine article is presented to whoever reads Harvard Magazine. It's particularly concerning to me right now because the timing of this whole thing is interesting. Like, Bartlett was obviously working on this Arizona Law Review paper last year before there could be any anticipation of school closings and everybody put into this forced distance learning kind of situation. But there's been a pretty steady drumbeat since schools started to close last month against homeschooling, like the Washington Post article that we've talked about, and then the appearance of this Harvard Magazine article. And I'm wondering, this is also one of the reasons why I think this is worth talking about and trying to amplify a pro-homeschool, pro-unschool position right now, is that opponents of home education are likely looking to seize on people's frustrations and fears at a time where people are already experiencing a fair amount of anxiety and trauma that could easily be extended into, you know, having your kids home all day. But just in our running start here to the continuation of my conversation with Corey, we'll talk about one more. I mentioned hasty generalizations, and I found an interesting one, a piece in a very progressive blog called The American Prospect that illustrates this well. It is called The Homeschool Apostates. In the existence of this blog and the existence of this article, it was brought to my attention in a pretty shocking way, but hold that thought for a while. It was written by Catherine Joyce, published all the way back in February 2014. The title again, I know I keep saying this, The Homeschool Apostates. Now, there's a slug line. A slug line is about a sentence, and it acts as a kind of expansion of a short and punchy title. And we certainly have that with the homeschool apostates. An apostate, if you're unfamiliar, is defined as one who has abandoned one's religious faith, a political party, one's principles, or a cause. Abandoned. Now, there's a clever manipulation here between the title and the slug line. The slug line is, they were raised to carry the fundamentalist banner forward and redeem America. But now the Joshua generation is rebelling. Okay, so if you look at how the slug line expands the title, we see where the apostate part goes. It goes to that second sentence, but now the Joshua generation is rebelling. Even though that word is not being used entirely correct there, and apostasy is not specifically a rebellion, but that's the alignment between the use of the word apostate and that sentence in the slug line. So where does the homeschool connection show up in the slug line? People who are carrying a fundamentalist banner forward. Those are the homeschoolers. People who are carrying a fundamentalist banner. Because, you know, some people just read headlines from their favorite news sites. Have you heard about this? And then for, a form of self-reassurance, they said, well, you know, I did also read the slug line. So it's interesting the kind of misconceptions you could walk away with just right there before you even get into Joyce's article. Now, an overview of this is she spotlights, and you want to be very precise with your spotlight here, people who came from, you know, fundamentalist or evangelical homeschooling backgrounds who wound up involved, interestingly enough, in the homeschool debate circuit. And apparently there was this idea with fundamentalist Christians that they could use these debate circles as a way to proselytize their religious beliefs. But as Joyce implies throughout this piece, because they learned to debate, they eventually discovered that everything they were involved in was bullshit, and now they're draining all their bathwater, including that bebé that is homeschooling. That is the most important, and I would speculate that as far as Joyce is concerned, that's the most important thing to go down the drain. Religious criticism is a pretty easy avenue to go after homeschooling, and you know, a lot of people on the left, and a lot of people in the libertarian community too, honestly, engage in this. I would say libertarians not to criticize homeschooling, but being like an atheist or being hostile towards Christianity, it's definitely part of the, like, I'm smarter than most people starter pack. So popular in like the Richard Dawkins, Bill Nye, Neil deGrasse Tyson fandom world. But obviously, if you can attach homeschooling to fundamentalist Christianity, even through, again, these super emotional arguments, people like Joyce, the author of this article, see that as a fairly reliable way, I would say, not to drain it, but to drown it. So she engages in a very hasty generalization of the entire homeschool population by telling these stories. I think she singles out like maybe as many as 10 pieces. It's a very long article. And it's as far as like a human interest story goes, it's not terrible, because I don't want to minimize or take anything away from abuse people might have suffered in what are very sick family situations. But then to generalize the entire population by focusing on, the abuse that some people suffered. And through my research of Joyce, I know that her work extends beyond criticism of homeschooling. But this highlight of abuse or heartbreak, I would call it Michael Moring, where, you know, somebody, you look at the basic formula for all Michael Moore's documentaries, right? It's kind of like he goes to these people that he's going to interview and he says, well, I'm here to help. I'm here to be your voice. And then he exploits their pain to make his point. And while I think I called it Michael Moring, and everybody knows, you know, what Michael Moore is all about. Well, I think the imagery manipulation is more like a propaganda tactic of the left. I think like every ideology has its own version of Michael Mooring. In 10 years of doing School Sucks, I'm sure I'm guilty of this too, when we talked about how kids were drugged or the abuse that go on in school. But it doesn't stop me from pointing out that Joyce, in this article, The Homeschool Apostates, is basically hijacking these stories for her own cause, right? Because these people are debaters. They're thinkers. And even though they were used by their fundamentalist parents as messengers of God by infiltrating homeschool debate circuits, it wound up backfiring because they learned to think, and therefore they reject everything that their fundamentalist parents tried to put upon them, including homeschooling. But a closer read of the article actually reveals that if they're concerned about anything, it's removing the kinds of abuses that they suffered. And when I say that she's hijacking it for her own cause, all she's doing with all of these really sincerely, like, heartbreaking stories of the use and abuse and mistreatment that the people who tell their stories in this article suffers, she's starting with a claim and then using personal stories to try and validate what she already believes. Therefore, as you heard in that exchange between Brian Ray and Samantha Field, if anecdotal evidence is all you have to try and build an emotional argument, it's very easy to expose that ultimately there's going to be some correlation problems and ultimately a very weak argument. But as you'll hear me mention as we start to dig into Barthollet's paper, one of the tactics that she uses is to tell some horrifying emotional thing, like you heard at the very beginning of this show, some horrible revelation about children discovered buried, that kind of thing. And then there will be legislation directly and responsibly responding to that thing. But obviously, stop me if you've ever heard about this before. Sometimes legislation or government policy can be a totally misguided overreaction. And also, now when we step back out of the homeschool apostates or NPR's debate or even what Barthollet is doing, and we look at the big picture that we've been discussing here over the last two shows, do you find it curious that people who are apparently so concerned with child welfare have decided to devote so much time and attention to less than 3% of the population, when every single one of their concerns could be more easily applied to the public school environment? So let's dig into this academic paper. Will it do a better job than faux NPR debates and slanted, hastily generalizing progressive blog articles? The answer may not surprise you. Here we go. Digging into some of the unchecked premises of the actual Arizona Law Review paper, I made a few notes as I went through it. The whole thing is like 80 pages long, but I would guess more than half of it is footnotes. Just the title. We didn't even tell people what the title was. Listen to the title, everybody. The title is Homeschooling, Parents' Rights Absolutism versus Child Rights to Education and Protection. And Elizabeth Barthollet is the author. She's going to come down on the side of child rights to education and protection. The abstract, like right at the top of this, it says, this article describes the rapidly growing homeschooling phenomenon and the threat it poses to children and society. Homeschooling activists have in recent decades largely succeeded in their deregulation campaign, overwhelming legislators with aggressive advocacy. As a result, parents can now keep their children at home in the name of homeschooling, free from any real scrutiny as to whether or how they are educating their children. Many homeschool because they want to isolate their children from ideas and values central to our democracy. Determined to keep their children from exposure to views that might enable autonomous choice about their future lives. Many promote racial segregation and female subservience. Many question science. Abusive parents can keep their children at home free from the risk that teachers will report them to child protection services. Some homeschool precisely for this reason. This article calls for a radical transformation in the homeschooling regime and a related rethinking of child rights. It recommends a presumptive ban on homeschooling with the burden on parents to demonstrate justification for permission to homeschool.
Guilty until proven innocent. That's exactly what that means.
Wow, that's a lot.
Burden of proof should be on the government to justify why they should be able to take our rights away. It's backwards.
All right, so I'm just gonna read some excerpts, and then I'm immediately gonna pass the mic to you because, like, I felt like if the whole show had worked this way, people would have said, "Why did Brett have Corey on if he's just gonna read things and then rant about them for 20 minutes?" Because that's certainly what could happen here. So I'm gonna pick some. So I'm gonna name a premise, and then I will just pass to you and get your thoughts. So this thing that's laid out, this is about midway through page 56, where it talks about how lobbying groups have prevented what they see as annoying state intrusions into the home and the consequences of that. So it kind of sets this up, and it does this over a course of a couple paragraphs. That, oh, you know, we're just trying to protect people, but homeschoolers keep getting in our way. I'm not even going to read all of this, but it's like the setup is gruesome thing happens to a child. Legislation comes out in response to this gruesome thing that happened to this child. People have enough grimness in their life right now, so I'll just like kind of skip the really ugly details. A bill was introduced in Kansas in 2015 in response to basically the killing of a 7-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. Legislation would have required that adults living in the same house as a child report child maltreatment. The homeschooling movement lobbied against the proposed bill, and it never moved forward. A bill was introduced in Michigan in 2015 in response to the death of 2 children and then all the gruesome details. They had been withdrawn from school for alleged homeschooling despite the mother's prior CPS involvement. That's Child Protective Services. The bill would have required that homeschoolers be registered with the local school district and meet with a mandatory reporter twice per year. HSLDA, that is the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, and the Michigan Freedom Fund, a conservative advocacy organization, criticized the bill. It never moved out of committee. Legislators in several states have tried to enact legislation monitoring homeschooling families with CPS histories and run into similar roadblocks. So there's a premise. Terrible thing happens. Rational and a responsible law directly responding to that terrible thing, and then homeschool advocates prevent it from happening.
Yeah, well, I guess we better ban government schooling too, because I can point to homicides that have occurred in government schools, and I can point to abuse instances in government schools too. So we can turn it right around, and I mean, that wouldn't be logical either to ban all types of schooling just because of a few cases of negative things occurring. And again, this is really the backlash is because this is essentially treating everyone as guilty until proven innocent. And as I said earlier, that's akin to saying, "Oh, well, you might feed your kids, you know, unhealthy food, and so that means every single family has to be subject to a government employee coming into their homes every single day to check and make sure what the families are serving for dinner is healthy in their view." That's right. A huge restriction on your rights. And again, it's being guilty until proven innocent. And that's completely backwards. We shouldn't have to prove our innocence. If there is evidence of wrongdoing, yes, of course. That has been reported to the government. There should be an investigation, and we should look into that. because abuse does happen in the homes, but it should be, the burden of proof should be on the government. The burden of proof should not be on families. For Elizabeth and others to argue that HSLDA has so much power, I mean, the Salon article argued this as well, or tried to make this argument that you discussed with Carrie McDonald. HSLDA's annual budget's only $11 million. That's only 2 to 3% of the budget of the National Education Association. So are you saying that HSLDA has much more power than the protectors of the government school system? And NEA is just one organization. They have an annual budget of around $374 million. You also have the American Federation for Teachers and other state-based teachers unions. So don't act like HSLDA is Goliath here. They may be Goliath right, in that they have the right ideas and that they win the logical battle. But as far as their power money-wise, they're David and they're winning the fight. And it's because of, you know, it's because, again, HSLDA has the right ideas.
It's passion versus bureaucracy, right? So exactly what you're trying to say, she really, really makes a strong effort to convince herself of this on page 45 and 46. Mm-hmm. She says, there is a wide range of critics of homeschooling, but none of them exercise real political power or have significant influence in shaping policy.
Get out of
which
here.
Which is just ridiculous if you think about what the status quo is. So then her justification is, and this is again to the premise that the HSLDA is powerful and unchallenged. Professional educators constitute the other main advocacy group critical of homeschooling. The National Education Association, NEA, the nation's largest teachers union, has taken a strong position against homeschooling being permitted at all. Well, no kidding.
Yeah, protect your monopoly.
And says that if permitted, licensing, curriculum, and testing requirements should apply. I was just talking about this on my show. However, the NEA has not embraced this cause with anything resembling the passion and resources of the homeschooling movement who care about... I'm sorry. I knew this would happen. I knew I would get this agitated. Obviously, a bunch of bureaucrats are not going to have a passion matched by people advocating for their own children. So that's not like an imbalance of power.
Well, and look at the pushback to the Harvard Magazine article. Do you think it went viral on social media because every single person who liked my tweet was a member of HSLDA? Or maybe it's because the original Harvard Magazine article and Elizabeth Barthollet's article had some ridiculous arguments in it, had some shoddy, unscientific claims, and had just a huge proposal to restrict everybody's liberties. Maybe it's because they had a ridiculous idea, and that's why people are pushing back. It's not because there's like super powerful lobbying groups organizing and coordinating this pushback. This is organic pushback from the bottom up through families who want to keep their right to educate their own children and who believe that the government is not the parent, that the parent is the parent.
Right. So when she in the paper, like right at the very beginning, she uses this term, it's in the title, parents' rights absolutism. Like, do you know there are people in America, good college educated followers of me, who are so crazy, you know, they don't think that they have to negotiate with the government in like the parenting of their own children. And she's entirely missing a dialectic here that's gone on for a century, right? Her starting point is like the state has never encroached on the family life or the lives of children. How? How has it ever done that? Oh, wait, yeah, it set up a school system 150 years ago, and then slowly over the course of 70, 80 years, it made everybody attend it for 15,000 hours. But other than that, what has the state ever really done to get involved in the lives of the average citizen? But these absolutists, these lunatics, feel like they have to be hypervigilant about protecting themselves from some imagined encroachment, right? So it's just ridiculous. She completely ignores everything that the government has done with respect to schooling since the 1840s.
Well, I mean, and the whole argument that, you know, there are some families who are going to indoctrinate their kids is just almost beyond parody, because the whole point of the government school system throughout history has been to indoctrinate kids. We didn't want those Catholics to be able to exercise their freedom of religion. We got to make them good American Protestant citizens.
Sure.
That was the whole argument for the government school system that was espoused by Horace Mann and others at the beginning of the school system. And I mean, similar arguments are made today. I mean, Elizabeth Barthollet is saying that well, there's some families who have Christian and conservative ideas that we can't have that. Why not? Why can't we have that? Why can't people freely exercise their religion? And why would you pretend like there isn't any indoctrination happening in government-run schools? Maybe it's just a different type of indoctrination that you agree with. Maybe it's okay if it's the type of indoctrination that you want.
Yeah. It reminds me, like, a lot of this just, there's a network. And if you're young, I hope you've never heard of this, listeners, called MSNBC. And if you've never heard of it, don't even go look into it. Just take my word for it. They used to cut these little promos. This was maybe like 3 or 4 years ago, where they'd have one of their really clever, who had MSNBC shows, Chris Matthews, Lawrence O'Donnell. And they had this woman for a while who I think was a college professor. And they cut this promo. I remember people, my inbox was just flooded with this like 3 years ago. And she's, I don't remember her name. I remember she had an academic background. And I remember her show did a lot of like hard-hitting stuff like how racist is Star Wars. And the promo was like, we have to move people away from this idea that children belong to parents. Do you remember? You ever see that?
We have never invested as much in public education as we should have, because we've always had kind of a private notion of children. Your kid is yours and totally your responsibility. We haven't had a very collective notion of these are our children. So part of it is we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families and recognize that kids belong to whole communities. Once it's everybody's responsibility and not just the households, then we start making better investments.
She's not at MSNBC anymore, but I actually tweeted about this, and that got a lot of pushback as well pretty recently. I think it's got like over 4,000 likes already, and people pushed back. Yeah, it's her argument was, well, we haven't really invested in education, which first of all is not true. We've increased spending in education by over 200% since 1960, even after adjusting for inflation. So in real dollars terms, we've invested in education more and more every year without getting any better results in the government school system. And we currently spend over $200,000 for a K-12 education for every single child in government school. So one, you know, we have invested in education, but our argument is, oh, well, we haven't really, you know, truly invested education and truly spent enough, because we got to get rid of this private notion that for whatever reason, your children are yours. That your children belong to your family or your community, and instead we need to move towards this idea that your children belong to the entire community. So essentially, you know, that was a paraphrase of her quote, but essentially she was saying your children don't belong to you, your children don't belong to your family, your children really belong to the community, and I can only think of that as being a government, right? A local government or the state government.
Yeah, it takes a village. Kind of stuff.
Yeah, the same idea. And yeah, there's a ton of a pushback to that.
So there's one more. And here's where things get really wild and wonderful. It happens right on page 6. So I'm looking at where is she getting information? That's kind of what we're going to focus on here, because she makes some pretty far out there claims. Most of them we've been over, Corey and I have been over in this conversation already, everybody. So page 6, she writes, many homeschooled children miss out on exposure to others with different experiences and values. Most all miss out on extracurricular activities like student government. A very large portion of homeschooling parents are ideologically committed to isolating their children from the majority culture and indoctrinating them in views and values that are in serious conflict with that culture. Some believe that women should be subservient to men. Others believe that race stamps some people as inferior to others. Many don't believe in the scientific method, looking to the Bible instead as their source for understanding the world. And then there is a footnote number 18 right after this. So I begin a little adventure. I go to the footnotes, And this is the like many or most
many,
don't
some.
Believe in the science. Yeah, don't believe in the scientific method. Rely on the Bible. No, I mean, of course, there's people who are like that.
Yeah,
women are subservient. But this is all very official here. And there's a footnote. So let's follow the footnotes. It says footnote number 18. See, I can't remember what it was. It said either C supra or infra 1B. So 1B is like this paper is organized just like we used to organize outlines in high school. So you have section 1A. B, C, etc. So I go to section 1B. She's referencing you to another part of her paper, which I thought was kind of an interesting maze to start walking through.
Footnotes
here.
Are a good place to hide bad ideas, right?
Wait till you hear. So here's what happens. I go to section 1B after footnote 18 tells me to, and I find this. A majority are, however, descendants of the original conservative wing, and this is about people who do homeschooling today. Estimates range, as discussed above, from a majority up to 90%. Yeah. So there's like 39% margin of error in there somewhere. Footnote 44. Go to footnote 44. See sources cited in supernote 33. So I go up to footnote 33.
Goose hunt.
And it's a link to a blog article in something called The American Prospect. This ends here. This is the primary material that this ends with. A blog article in The American Prospect. The American Prospect, by the way, according to Wikipedia, is a daily online and quarterly print American and political public policy magazine dedicated to American liberalism and progressivism based in Washington, D.C. The Prospect says it aims to, quote, advance liberal and progressive goals through reporting, analysis, and debate about today's realities and tomorrow's possibilities. Title of the article that all of this footnoting leads to, The Homeschool Apostates.
Yep.
Slugline, they were raised to carry the fundamentalist banner forward and redeem America, but now the Joshua generation is rebelling. I was stunned.
And there's the word 90%. I'm looking at it now. It says for 90% of the population, that's their frame of reference. But there's no citation as to where they got that 90% number. So why is an academic journal article, again, academic in quotes, why is it using a citation of a blog instead of an actual study of the proportion of families who are homeschooling? And why are they using, even if this is a legitimate study, I mean, it looks like a blog post to me with no citation where they got the 90%. Why would they not provide what the preponderance of the evidence says? Why not provide the most recent survey on this? This looks like it's back from 2004, this blog post.
Yeah. Well, the Homeschool Apostates article I saw February 10th as a publication date there. But I remember that MTV show, it was called Punked, where like they just played pranks on people. I felt like that at the end. Like this ends here at some blog that's just like Slate or Salon or the Huffington Post. Like I got redirected through four footnotes to get to this. And this is like material for building your argument?
Well, and I mean, even if it was a legitimate source, it doesn't look like it is. And I don't know where the heck they got the 90. Like, did they just ask 10 of their friends over at Harvard? Do you think that people are homeschooling for religious reasons? Oh, 9 of them said yes. I mean, I think the most recent evidence I've shown was again, you know, more close to closer to 50%, you know, or 60% chose to homeschool their kids for any religion. For any religious reason. So for them to say that it's 90% are Christians that homeschool, that seems to be, you know, pretty far out there. And even if it is, again, like why all the anti-religious bigotry and fear mongering when we have the right to pursue a religion and religious education in the United States?
Well, because if you or your students or the readers of your paper have never talked to anyone who, you know, has a different worldview, then you can throw the word Christian and then around it, there's just this heuristic of like, oh, I get it. That's like a person who does stuff with snakes, right? They like handle snakes. Is that what a Christian is? They're the people who pass the snakes around at church. And you know, you can wind up with just some wild caricature of some complete fool who obviously needs to have their lives directed by smart, responsible people like Harvard professors and all of their students and their readers and their followers.
Yeah, and all of these claims are just, again, you read it, you read the direct text, but it's, I mean, there is that one 90% that came out of nowhere, came, you know, came from a blog post, which doesn't cite where they got the 90%. But I mean, most of the statements are many, some, there are a few, you know, this happens, but why not be more rigorous about it and actually try to put numbers to it? Because right. how much is many? I don't know. Like, is 0.0001% many to you? What do you think is many? You know, and the author of the article should at least provide some sort of range, you know? Yeah. And it just seems completely unscientific and ridiculous to just use words like some and many and without providing any evidence.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of it in the early going here in this piece, because most people don't go to this source material even. They're happy to take their information about it from Harvard Magazine, even though the comments before they shut the comments off, like we mentioned earlier, the comments were all just destroying basically what the article lays out. The first comment, the most upvoted comment, was just like, I'm a homeschooler. You have no idea what you're talking about. This is just like in the, if there was like a course on how to respond to anti-freedom arguments, I feel like this thing would be like level one. This would be like the training wheels. Like, it just seemed like so lazy, like, so lazy and outdated, this kind of argument about homeschooling. Like, you would expect that something that was developed in 2019 would just be more sophisticated or relevant to the current time. I back in the day, Corey, I used to like to like grab the Slate or Salon article and tear it apart on the podcast. But after a while, I was just like, you know, this is probably just written by libertarians who are probably trying to make the left look bad. Or it's written by progressives who are just trying to troll libertarians into wasting their time responding to it. So I don't know. But yeah, this was interesting. And I thought because of the timing where more and more Americans are going to find themselves faced with this choice, because of unfortunate circumstances, it's interesting that this is getting its volume turned up right now, even though it doesn't look like it was created in response to the current crisis. But I'm very appreciative of people like you, people like Carrie, Pat Ferenga, Kevin Soling, for being on top of this and putting this event together, in addition to all the responding that you have already done on Twitter and with articles. So can you tell my audience where they can find you? Then we'll just go over the details for this counter summit to what's happening at Harvard.
Yeah, find me on Twitter. I mean, that's the easiest way to contact me. My handle is just my last name and then my first name, at DeAngelis Corey. My DMs are open, so don't send me any naughty things or things that I don't want to see. But send me any of your inquiries through direct message, and I'll be more than happy to respond to you. You can also find my work on Reason Foundation, reason.org. You can just Google Corey DeAngelis Reason Foundation, and you'll be able to find my work that way as well.
Excellent. In your role there, you're the director of school choice.
Director of school choice. And who knows, maybe I'll change that to director of education choice in the future, or even director of educational freedom in the future, because this is much bigger than school choice. And I think a lot of people understand that. But yes, my official title at the moment is director of school choice at the Reason Foundation. I'm also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute and the executive director of Educational Freedom Institute.
Awesome. And what are the details on this upcoming event one more time?
Yeah, this will be May 1st. It'll be live streamed at the Harvard Kennedy School's website via Zoom. May 1st, which is this coming Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern time. And it's a publicly available event, unlike the other conference. We are more than happy to allow opposing opinions and views to be able to see our ideas, because we believe we have the better idea here. So it's publicly available. You can go check it out. There's a Facebook event if you want to look for it. You can Google the Disinformation Campaign Against Homeschooling is the name of the event. You can find it on Facebook, but you can also find it at the Harvard Kennedy School's website. So yeah, the best way is the Disinformation Campaign Against Homeschooling. Just Google it and you'll find a bunch of links.
Awesome. Corey, I'm so glad we finally got to talk. We'll have to do it again in the near future.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It was great talking to you, and I'm more than happy to talk again in the future.